To answer is human. To question is divine. Welcome to the world of the Hidden Gateway, an exhilarating podcast exploring the concepts humans have been struggling with since the dawn of existence, such as, who are we? Is there such a thing as good and evil, or are they arbitrary constructs? Does the paranormal exist? How can we evolve to a higher state? Can our mind influence what we term as reality? Providing a transcendental approach combined with hard-nosed humanistic analysis, we invite you on a journey to question your worldview in this theater of life. Join our host, Justin Williams, as he explores the outer realms of faith, the supernatural, human potential, and even our concepts of the universal creator with a fascinating array of guests. This is the unseen world, magical, mysterious, and mystical, where your only limitation is your imagination. This is the Hidden Gateway.
Welcome to another episode of the Hidden Gateway podcast. I am your host, Justin Williams, and today's guest is The Little Shaman. Now, The Little Shaman is a spiritual coach and a narcissism specialist who helps clients worldwide. Some of her offerings are monthly workshops, rehab programs that focus on toxic relationships, and even consultations for wellness professionals. She also believes in natural living, natural healing, and natural medicine. Today, The Little Shaman and I are going to discuss recognizing toxicity to restore your purpose and a whole lot more. Little Shaman, I'm grateful to have you here today. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, brother. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you for being here. This is a treat for the Hidden Gateway podcast. Now, the first thing, just tell me about yourself. Tell us about yourself. How did you get into healing, you know, victims of narcissistic abuse? How long have you been doing it? I'm curious to know.
Well, let's see. I think I started to channel 5 years ago, or no, it's probably more than that, 5 or 6. I don't remember exactly, but people started asking me if I did consultations, if I do workshops, if I do speaking engagements. And so, you know, since I saw that there was a need for that, then I just started doing it. And the reason that I created the channel in the first place is because I myself, of course, went through a situation with, now that what I now know are multiple narcissistic people. But this was, you know, it was a long time ago, and there wasn't, now you can type in on YouTube or even just into Google, you know, what is this? What does this behavior mean? This, you know, you couldn't do that then. And nothing that I came across seemed to really describe my situation. And that's because this sterile clinical criteria of something doesn't give you any idea of what it's like to live with somebody that has these problems, or, you know, and that's almost the same for everything, I think. And so that's why I started doing the channel. And I guess it just kind of came from there. I never wanted anybody to go through what I went through, that bewilderment for years of not knowing what the problem was.
Right. Okay. How long did you go through your issue? And what would you say is the biggest thing that you learned from it? If it was one takeaway that you use today in helping others, what would it be?
Well, let's see. I went through it for, it was a long time. Because there were years, it was years because he became diagnosed while I was married to him. And I think the biggest takeaway from that I learned was that you cannot control other people. You can't do the work for them. You can't make them see something they don't want to see, because particularly with narcissistic people, this is where we kind of learn that lesson. Because with narcissistic people, you can be holding tangible proof of something in front of them, and they'll just say that, nope, that's not true. This is not what happened. This is not the thing. And it's like, but I have, what do you mean? This is a picture of you doing it, or whatever, you know, but it's still the same thing. And so I think the most important thing I learned
was that you can't control other people. You really, truly can't. I mean, you, if somebody doesn't want to believe you, if they don't want to listen to you, if they don't want to do something, they won't. And it doesn't matter how much you want them to, and it doesn't matter how strong your evidence that they should, it doesn't matter. And so that, I think, is really important for the ego work that we all eventually end up having to do. That was a big part of that, of understanding that you can only control yourself. I only have control over myself. I can't control anybody else's thoughts or feelings or opinions or anything, their perception, the way they view the world, nothing. So that was huge for me. And it was a hard thing to understand too, because, you know, we all kind of live in this world where we're so influential, right? All our egos tell us all the same thing, but the truth is that's not true. Everybody else's ego is telling them the same thing.
Well said. That's a golden lesson. You can't control other people. You know, a ton of people go through that, been there, done that myself. And I learned that once I was able to realize that, that gave me this certain sense of freedom, and you know, it improved life tremendously. So thank you. That's good to know. Can you just let our listeners know, the differences or the different types of narcissisms or narcissistic abuse? You know, obviously there's covert, et cetera. Can you just touch on that for a few minutes?
Sure. You'll see a lot of things about there are 7 kinds of narcissists and 10 kinds of narcissists and all the different kinds of narcissists. The truth is there's really only 2 sort of subtypes, and they're really not that different. There are covert narcissists. Covert means hidden or like not obvious, and overt means obvious. Overt is the sort of the stereotypical idea of a narcissist where the person's very, you know, braggadocious, or they might be really aggressive. They probably care a lot about what they look like, or their image is really, really important to them in terms of they want to seem like the best, or the, you know, that kind of thing that we associate with the word narcissist. A covert narcissist, in my opinion, is actually more dangerous because they're a lot harder to see. Covert narcissists can come across as very vulnerable, sort of needy or victim-like in some ways. There are ones that can seem very sort of like magnanimous and very generous, or there are those that seem to be like the hero in the situation. And it's very hard for your eyes and your brain to make sense of this person seems to be this, but it makes me feel bad. I feel like they're controlling me. I don't really know how to put my finger on it, but something's wrong. And one of the things that's really important for people to understand is manipulation is manipulation no matter how it's being done. Control is control no matter how it's being taken. So for example, if let's talk about a type of abuse. So if somebody stops you from going out to a party with your friends because they physically attack you, or because they lock you in a room or something like that. So that's very overt. It's very obvious. This person is controlling me. But if someone prevents you from going to the party with your friends because they have a meltdown, or maybe they threaten to harm themselves or something like that, that's the same thing. It's still very controlling. It's very manipulative, but it doesn't necessarily come across like that. Does that make sense?
It does. Would you consider that a act of selfishness as well?
It's all about motive, right? Because it might be that somebody just really is falling apart because they can't stand the idea of someone going out somewhere without them or whatever, but it's still an unhealthy thing. So I guess it depends on how we're defining selfishness. If we're saying selfishness is intentional, then maybe not. But if we're saying selfishness is just kind of considering yourself before everybody, then maybe, yeah.
Now, do you believe narcissists are spiritually evil, meaning possessed with some type of evil entity?
I think that if there are people who are more susceptible, because I would hate to make a blanket statement that they all are one thing or the other, because they're people, and people are very diverse. They're very complex. It's just like the answer to the last question. It could be that someone really is having a crisis, or it could be that they're just trying to manipulate you. It's very hard to say. And so I would say, if there are people who are vulnerable to that, then these are the type of people that it would be. Because, for example, evil in spiritual terms is the presence of something like a demon or a spirit or a dark energy, something that is an influence. Whereas evil in science would be the absence of something, for example, a conscience or empathy. And so it's my opinion that you cannot have a presence unless an absence already exists. So if the presence would be, if somebody would be vulnerable to a presence, it would be because they have an absence. Does that make sense to you?
So does that mean it's kind of like two in one? So am I following correctly?
I think that if that exists, like if there are people who are having any type of influence or possession, then this is probably those type of people. Yeah.
Okay.
And I've seen some things. I mean, believe me. So, you know, and it's very, I can understand why a lot of people think that too. Because first of all, you know, they, whenever they get into a rage, a narcissist or a psychopathic person, they look different. The look in their eyes is different. Sometimes their face is different. And they may speak differently. They're very different. And so It's hard to say. Like I said, I have seen some things. I don't count it out at all. I'll tell you that.
Right. Because I was thinking about that recently. And then I kind of thought, you know, just based off my research, it has to be the case. Maybe not with everyone. Mm-hmm. But I tend to think that it's very widespread. Right. And
no, I agree.
Yeah. I know you said you've seen some things. Are you able to share what you've seen? To make you say, that could definitely or possibly be some type of spiritual evilness going on with that person.
Yeah, you know, mostly a look in the eyes is what I would see. And I saw it more than one time. That really just looks like the person is not there. And if you know what I mean by seeing something behind someone's eyes, where maybe, you know, something else is there. I don't know if that makes any sense. It wasn't there all the time. And, you know, it's hard to explain, but you probably know what I mean. And I know
exactly what you mean. Yes, I've seen it.
Yep. So it's hard to say, you know, I'm very fact-based and very science-based, but also there's room for spirituality. I'm one of those people who doesn't think that science and spirituality cancel each other out. I do not think they're mutually exclusive at all. So I think that it's very possible that either one or the other is occurring, or that both could be happening. Because also, if we look at it, so spiritually speaking, pathological narcissism would be everything that turns you away from your relationship with God. It would be ego, it would be selfishness, it would be preoccupation with, you know, earthly things, your own needs, your own stuff, your pain, your pleasure, those are the things that your ego, so ego is what gets in the way of spirituality. Just in general, right? So it's, yeah, that would be, I can see where people get the idea from. I don't think it's far-fetched at all.
Now, before we came on, you and I were talking a bit, and you said something very interesting, something I found very interesting. You said narcissists have a bad crisis of faith.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, it sort of dovetails with what we were just saying, which is, you know, that this is what pulls you away from God. I have spoken to two different people that claimed that the narcissist in their life was cured, was healed, and a better relationship, or I guess establishing one at all with God and devoting themselves, was what they said brought about the change. So I have no facts behind that. I don't know if they're telling the truth or not, but those are the only two instances I ever heard of someone saying, I saw this behavior in someone for years and now it's gone. So I don't know if they're telling the truth. I don't know them personally or anything like that, but I'm just relating to you what I was told. And I've been told that by more than one person. So, and also, you know, we have in spirituality, something that we call the dark night of the soul, which is, it can be a long explanation, but the simple way to say it would be sort of everything that you have been trying to avoid kind of comes crashing on you, right? In your life, about yourself, kind of comes all on you at the same time. And you have the choice to either go through that, go through the pain and come out stronger, or keep running away from it. And I think that narcissistic people, not all of them, of course, because it's a spectrum, but a lot of them are in sort of a perpetual dark night of the soul, where the mirror is kind of being held up and saying, hey, look, you know, you need to address this. This needs to be fixed. This needs to be taken care of. This needs to be healed. And they keep turning away because they're afraid.
With that fear?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Oh, I was saying, do they have the ability to be happy or the ability to deal with that fear?
It doesn't seem to be so, no, because, you know, pathological narcissism doesn't exist in somebody because they chose to lack these abilities that they lack, if you see what I'm trying to say. It exists in them because they don't have them in the first place. So, and once again, it's a spectrum. You know, we don't want to make a huge blanket statement for everyone that has any narcissistic problems that this is how it is. But for the people who are pathologically narcissistic, they do not seem to possess the tools to be able to do that, no. And it seems to be because they have like arrested development where, for whatever reason, their emotional development and these things, they did not occur. And we have, you know, we have theories why that happens, but no one really knows. And so they don't have the tools. So for example, if they were going to learn how to deal with fear, then they would have to learn how to process things, how to have, you know, self-awareness and introspect. These are just not, they just don't have those tools. And in order to learn them or to be able to use them, a person has to have a sort of a basic framework to kind of build these things onto. And for them, not only do they not have that basic framework, they have some other different maladaptive one in place of it. So it would be like, if you're trying to build a house, or what you're trying to build an addition onto a house, and the frame of the house cannot support the additions. So in order to put the additions on, you have to go into the original house, pull out the original frame, and replace it without destroying the house. I don't know how you do that.
Wow. Yeah. That would be very, very challenging to do. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Goodness. Okay. Now, what are your thoughts of narcissists being beneficial or adding value to society? You know, obviously a lot are CEOs, entertainers, athletes, doctors, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that they offer a true value to society? So, I mean, maybe they do these things that are helpful for people, but then they also cause a lot of abuse. Like, where do you draw that line? Where is it acceptable or not acceptable? How do you even compare the two?
Well, and that's for wider heads than mine. I mean, to me, it seems like, and we were discussing before that the spiritual significance, perhaps, or relevance of these people is that they show you where you need to heal. And I guess why God would want to do it like that, I don't know. I have no idea. But you are correct that there, and people sometimes get angry at me for saying this, because they do. There are many who are, like you said, CEOs. I'm sure there are plenty of doctors and scientists and lots of different types of people that are narcissists or psychopaths. So to say they have absolutely no value whatsoever would be, you know, erroneous. You know, that's not what we would say. That would not be factual. But as far as each individual person, because if we're talking about them collectively as a group of narcissistic people as a whole, then I think it's easier to sort of see their value than if we take, for example, this one guy and look at what he did in his life versus the harm that he's caused, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Right. Well, then, you know, it kind of takes me back to what you said a minute ago, where narcissists can help the victim learn about themselves, right? So, mm-hmm. I mean, it makes me think about that, the yin and the yang, right? Like they add that value to life, you know, just to keep things in balance. That's interesting. Okay.
Well, and not only that, but one of the things that I always tell the clients that I speak to, many of them are victims of narcissistic abuse, whether it's through relationships, whether it's through, you know, that because it was one of their parents, that's actually extremely common. And, or sometimes it's both, right? That's really, really common. And so one of the things that I always tell them is, you know, through this is a lot of times you learn how to love yourself in self-defense. Because it's truly, because, and it would be wonderful if we could learn that without this happening. And I guess a lot of people do, but unfortunately, I guess I couldn't. So, you know, because when you see your flaws and your mistakes and your bad choices and often stuff that doesn't even belong to you, magnified and blown up into this humongous, just ridiculousness, there will often come a point, usually actually, if it goes on long enough, where people just kind of stop and say, wait, you don't know, that's not true. This is not me. This doesn't belong to me. And through seeing this stuff blown up to these enormous proportions, a lot of times what happens is people eventually realize, like, I'm not that bad. I'm not that bad of a person. I'm actually all right. And also true that what happens too is, for example, if someone stays in their relationship for 10 years, what they will find is that they mature and the narcissist does not. And so that's part of it too. The older they get, the less these things will affect them because they're becoming more comfortable with themselves and they're maturing and they're understanding different things. So that also happens too.
Now, early on, you said that you believe covert narcissists are the most difficult ones to deal with because they're sneaky in a way, you know. And I've also heard these other terms such as energy vampires, mm-hmm. And you know, with the controllers, the victims, the constant talker, the drama queens,
yep.
The judgmentals, the dominators. What do those fall under? Do those fall under covert, or do they fall under both, or what can you tell me about energy vampires? That's what I want to know about.
Probably. Well, I think they're all energy vampires. That's sort of the universal characteristic. It may be that some are a little sneakier than others, but the key way to identify an energy vampire is that when you're done dealing with this person, because you know how it is, if you're hanging around with someone that you like, or you're hanging around with someone that's your friend and y'all get along and everything like that, you usually feel pretty exhilarated, right? After being around those kind of people. But with an energy vampire, you will not feel that way. You will feel, a lot of times people feel exhausted. Or, for example, for me, if I'm around people who are, because that's a real thing, you know, energy vampire, it's a real thing. And so if I'm around someone like that, a lot of times my back will start hurting. And so because it gets tired, I guess, and you often, people will have these little sort of personal telltale things. Sometimes people will get a headache. Sometimes people find themselves kind of getting irritated, getting in a bad mood. So pay attention to what your body is telling you. Because that's the number one characteristic of an energy vampire is that you don't feel good after you're around them.
Now, what's the best way to deal with narcissists? You know, I had someone tell me recently that because narcissists, they demand this attention, they were saying, well, hey, you got to give them that attention in a certain way. But my thought is, I'm not trying to do that. I'm trying to go the other way and just have nothing to do with them whatsoever. So with the people that you help, how do you, like, obviously every situation is different, but what's the best way to approach it? You know, if someone's married to someone that's a narcissist or a group of friends, maybe one or two of those friends are narcissists, or even their supervisor at their job, I'm sure that's pretty relevant as well.
Yes, it is, unfortunately. That's, in my opinion, one of the worst situations because Narcissists at your job are very hard to get away from unless you quit your job. And a lot of people, that's just not in the realm of possibility for them to do. So that's really, really awful. Excuse me. Not that any of the other ones are great. I mean, they're all bad. And so, but I think that if you have to be around them, then the best way to deal with them without you going crazy is to use what we call the Grey Rock method, which is responding without reacting, right? So, because narcissistic people, and we've all heard this, that they need power and control. And so the reason that they need power and control is because they feel like they don't have any. It's almost like being stuck in this mindset of being like a kid, where, because children are truly powerless. I mean, they really are. If their mom wants to move to Florida and they don't want to, you know, they have to go. Or if something is happening to them that an adult is doing, so what can they really do? They really can't do anything. Maybe go tell somebody, and that's about it. So children really are powerless in a large way, in a real way. And so narcissistic people kind of never really shook that off, I guess. And they really attempt to feel like they have power, or feel like they can control people through, a lot of times it's through emotional reactions. And so one of the ways that you can sort of de-weaponize their behavior is by learning to control your own emotions and not reacting to them. So for example, if a narcissist says something that's very inflammatory, because that's, you know, they're very known for that kind of thing, where it's, let's say two people are divorced and they're talking about when can we pick up the kids, and then one of them says, you know, the narcissistic one says, well, I guess I'll just be there at 5 o'clock because we all know that you don't want the kids to see me anyway. Then, so your first reaction is to say, no, that's not true, blah, blah, blah. But the best answer is just, okay, so yeah, fine, right? But don't react to their provocations if you have to be around them. Because unfortunately, anything else is encouraging. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter if you're yelling at them. You could be cussing them out. You could. It doesn't matter if you're being nice, if you're being mean, if you're whatever. That's encouraging to them. Sort of like how they tell you not to reward a tantrum when your kids are little. They say, you know, don't reward a tantrum and stuff like that. It's similar to the same thing. It's the same with everybody. Any behavior that is rewarded will be repeated, whether somebody's an adult or a child or whatever. So to my mind, and from the feedback that I received from clients, and, you know, I've probably talked to thousands of people by now, that is the thing that works the best. It doesn't control their behavior, the narcissist's behavior, but remember, so like, we can't do that. And so if what you're doing, it has the aim of controlling them, then first of all, there's the wrong, you know, you're focused on the wrong thing here, but also it doesn't work, because you can be as nice as pie to this kind of person and they're still really nasty to you. It doesn't really do anything. And plus, we want to get out of the sort of idea that our behavior is controlling their behavior, because that is what reinforces the cycle of abuse. Because the abuser says to the victim, I did this because you did that, or you made me, or you provoked me. That's not true. People have a choice with how they act. And in no relationship do you see that better and more clearly than with narcissists, because no matter how nice you are, no matter how much you do for them, it doesn't matter. They still choose to behave, you know, in a rotten way, abusively. So, you know, the best way to approach it, in my opinion, is to remember you can't control anybody else. You can't control their thoughts. You can't control their feelings. You cannot control their actions. There's nothing you can do. If they don't want to believe you, if they don't want to be nice to you, if they don't want to have a normal conversation without arguing, if they can't communicate, there's nothing you can do. The only thing you can do is control you. And it's important to remember that the Grey Rock method is not a long-term strategy for dealing with narcissistic people. There is no long-term strategy for dealing with narcissistic people.
Do narcissists truly love themselves? Do they even know what love is? I mean, I would think that the majority of them would want you to believe that, oh yeah, I love myself, I'm all this, I'm all that. But is that just a cover for a deeper pain, a deeper hurt, a deeper fear?
It seems to be, yes. And the idea that narcissists are happy seems to have come from, for example, in the clinical environment or in academia, where they interview narcissists and they say, are you happy? You know, and there is now finally some headway being made in this area where, because they're doing different kind of studies and kind of comparing them, they are realizing that people who are truly narcissistic cannot be relied upon to self-report. And the reason for that is because, first of all, they will lie. It's also because a lot of them are so disconnected from themselves and from their inner landscape that they, like you said, do they even know what love is? If you ask them, do you feel love? How do you know they know what that is? How do you know that what you might mean by that is what they mean by that? You don't know that. And the more you talk to them, the more you realize what you mean by things you say and what they mean by saying similar things is not the same. So it's like, and also another reason they can't be relied upon to self-report is because narcissistic people, and not all of them, once again, my comments are, you know, general because narcissism is a spectrum, but narcissistic people are often looking for the quote right answer. And the right answer would be either the one that they think you're expecting them to give, or the one that is the one that says there's nothing wrong with me, right? So if someone says to you, are you happy? Which answer says there's nothing wrong with you? Yes, I'm happy, or no, I'm not.
Right. No, I'm not.
Exactly. So, and that's, so they're trying to give the right answer, so to speak. So if you ask them, in a clinical setting where you're a scientist and you got a piece of paper or they're filling something out and this is a study, you know, in a survey, and hey, their answers are very important, right? Because they definitely think that.
They're not going to want to give the quote unquote wrong answer. Or it's really not even about being wrong. It's just about not being right, if that makes any sense.
Not being right. Yeah.
And that's really what it is. And so it's like, you can't believe that, because now studies they're doing in other areas are showing that that's actually not true. They're not happy. For example, there are studies that show that narcissists struggle really badly with anxiety, or that they feel stress more strongly than people who are not narcissistic. There are a lot of different things here. And anyone who has lived with a narcissistic person will tell you these people are not happy. They are afraid. They are confused. They don't, because, and that's another thing too, that happens when, for example, you don't have empathy that functions really well, is because empathy, we always think of empathy like serial killers and psychopaths and these rotten people that abuse animals. Like, you think that's having no empathy, and it is. But empathy can also show up in other ways. For example, it can show up as indifference. It can show up as not understanding. It can show up as being confused about why other people perceive you the way that they do. It doesn't just show up as cruelty. There are some other indicators that someone doesn't really have any empathy because they don't understand the way that other people feel. They really don't. And so, excuse me, there's a lot that goes into this, and, you know, they just seem very unhappy. And even just, if we take science out of it and just an observation, common sense thing, do people who are happy, do people who love themselves, who love others, is this the kind of person that needs to go around putting everybody else down so that they feel better? I mean, that's not what people who are happy do. If you look at their behavior, they're not happy. This is not someone who's happy. This is not someone who loves themselves.
Let's help my single people out, right? Mm-hmm. So what are some of the signs that people need to look out for when a guy meets a girl or a girl meets a guy for the first time, and they, you know, they go out on a date? Like, what signs should people look for in the opposite sex or same sex that could be a trigger or a red flag to say, this person may be a narcissist?
Well, one of the bigger signs would be people who talk about themselves nonstop. And, you know, I mean, some people do that when they're nervous, right? Because they're trying to put all the, this is all very, you know, sort of contextual and taking some observations. It's like, again, to the question about, is someone threatening or having a crisis, or are they threatening suicide to be manipulative? This is very contextual, right? And so it's like, but if someone's, it's about the context. So if someone is, if they are talking about themselves continuously and they don't ask anything about you, that's probably something that, because whether it means they're a narcissist or not, obviously they're not, this is probably not going to be that great of a match, right? And so if they talk about themselves a lot, they don't really ask about you. If they tell you things that seem conflicting, because you would be surprised how many people, even just over a 2-hour date, somebody says one thing in the beginning of the date, and then at the end of the date, they've contradicted themselves more than once. So pay attention to that. Someone who seems like it's really important to them to kind of impress you or to give you a certain opinion of them. Someone who comes on really strong. And I don't necessarily mean in a sexual way. I just mean like really over, because one of the first red flags we notice with any narcissist is that they overreact. And usually we think of that in terms of something small happened and they blew up about it, but love bombing, idealizing people, those are overreactions too. And so it's like, if someone is really overly complimentary, and once again, some people do stuff like that when they're nervous. So it's really in the context of the thing. If they say things about that you guys would be perfect together and what would our children look like, and anybody that really seems like they're trying to move too fast is a gigantic red flag. That is probably the biggest one. Or someone who y'all have had one date and so they text you and then you don't text them back because you went to bed or you were talking to your girls or your homies or whatever, right? And then so then they get upset and they're like, well, you didn't message, you know, stuff like that where it seems like this person's trying to get really intense, really really fast. That's one of the bigger things to look out for, because it's very easy to get swept off your feet with that kind of thing. Or it's very easy to say, oh, wow, this person must really be into me. No, 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 they don't even know you. They're not into you. They're into whatever they think that you can give them, or they're very afraid and are trying to grab onto somebody, because that is also what happens with narcissistic people. Their relationships are very transactional, but in a parasitic way. So for example, transactional is like, I have a dollar, and I go to the store and the man at the store has a soda and I have a dollar. So I'm going to give him my dollar. He's going to give me a soda, right? That's transactional. But I don't have to go there and buy soda. You know, I don't need soda. Whereas parasitically speaking, narcissists need other people because they're not able to put it very simply and not go into a wrong thing. Narcissistic people have extreme difficulty or an inability to experience themselves without the reactions or input of other people. This is very difficult for them. So they need other people, very much like a small child has no self-concept and they have no self-esteem. We're talking about really small, like a baby. They rely on the caretaker to mirror these things to them so they can start building one. And for narcissists, they have never... they don't have the ability to build one. That's what they need other people for. You might have heard of something called narcissistic supply. That is what they are getting from other people. It supplies them with something in place of their own self-worth and self-esteem because they don't have the ability to make any.
Yeah, I was going to ask about narcissistic supply. I've heard about that. In fact, I think I heard that term for the first time about a week or so ago. So can you say that again? Can you say that one more time, please?
Sure thing. Narcissistic supply is, for example, someone like me or someone like you, we have an identity and a core sense of who we are to base things on. So if something happens and we have a setback or we have a failure or just sort of walking around in everyday life, we have our own system of checks and balances. You know, if something bad happens, we can say, well, you know I can do this and I have this and I've accomplished this, and you can balance that out, right? That's your self-worth and your self-esteem. They don't have the ability to do that. If they're not receiving attention, which would be the input, even if it's good, even if it's bad, whatever it is, doesn't matter. If they're not receiving that from other people, it's a catastrophe. It's catastrophic because, let me give you a metaphor. If you have a pitcher with a hole in the bottom, right? Like, you know, like a pitcher that you would put juice or something in. And let's say that there's a hole in the bottom. And so then I say to you, okay, it's a hole in the bottom of this, but you have to keep it at a constant level. So you would put it under the faucet going full blast. And even though some will leak out, it will stay at a constant level. But it probably won't be very much in there. So if you, because it's going to drain out as soon as you turn the faucet off. That's how their quote unquote self-worth works. And I say quote unquote because it's not actually what it is. It's other worth, like they're worth to other people. And so that's one of the reasons why narcissistic people often have more than one source of supply, is because if you put it under one faucet, it'll stay at a constant level, but it probably won't be very much. But if there's five faucets, well, it's going to be a lot fuller, isn't it?
Interesting. Very interesting. So we talked about single people meeting people for the first time, first couple dates, you know, ways to identify. Now, how about how about people that have been in a relationship for 6 months, a year, 2 years, and, you know, all seems well for the first 90 days, and then these red flags come up, and then a person learns about narcissism and narcissists. What questions should they be asking themselves to discover? Are they actually in a toxic relationship? Is it kind of same with some of the same questions that you mentioned for the single folks, or would it be a bit different because there at this point has been an established relationship?
Some of them are the same because the red flags, unfortunately, are not going to change very much. And what we find, they're just going to get worse, if you see what I'm saying. And what we find is that the longer you're in a relationship, it's really like it never goes anywhere. Like a relationship with a non-narcissistic person that you were in for 10 years would be very deep. There would be a lot of intimacy. There would be a lot of, you know, the other person really well. They know you really well. That doesn't happen with narcissists. You might think that's what's happening, but when you step back and examine the situation, what you realize is you really don't know them very well, and they don't know you either. You know, and for example, in my situation, after 17 years, this person did not know my favorite color. Did not know my favorite color. And it had never changed, you know, it was the same since I was like 12. And it was, you know, so that was eye-opening. And I, you know, because when this was all going on, I didn't know anything about any of this. I found it all out later, a long time later. So I really didn't know. I just thought that was like, man, you got a terrible memory. But what I realized was he didn't care. That's why he didn't remember. Why is that important? It's not. And so that's another thing too. If you're talking about what questions people can ask themselves or each other, I guess, maybe if it's a friend of theirs or something like that, is this someone that seems to really know nothing about you? Do they listen when you talk to them? Do they allow you to have a side? Can you actually communicate with them? And we're not just talking about, can you talk about superficial stuff? Although a lot of people will tell you in some ways, narcissistic people are very boring. It's like a TV show character that can only recite the lines from the script and you can't talk about anything else. You know what I mean? But it's true. But also, you know, there is no real depth. And if you try to have a conversation about something that has depth, or if you try to work out a conflict, there will be avoidance, there will be deflection. There will be, you know, you never can resolve anything. You can't get to the heart of anything. Something that you might notice too is that this person either does not or cannot talk about their feelings. That's a big red flag for narcissism, is that when you ask them about feelings, they can't answer you. For example, I have narcissists as clients as well, a couple of them. And whenever I ask them a question, you know, I'll say, so how did that make you feel? And this, I saw this with my ex. I saw this with numerous other people I've known. I've heard it from clients too, where I'm saying, okay, so how does that make you feel? And they say, well, I thought this, or I said that, or I did this. And I remember one client went on an answer that was probably like 5 minutes long, or maybe even 10. And he said, well, does that answer your question? And I said, no, it doesn't answer my question, because what I want to know is, how did it make you feel? And he, you know, and you see this all the time. They're just really not able to answer. And it's either because they don't know, you know, studies are showing now that narcissistic people have extreme difficulty identifying their own emotional states and those of other people. They really don't seem to understand. And so they oftentimes think their feelings are facts. That's a big one. So you might hear stuff from them like, you say, well, why do you think that? Or where did you get this idea? Well, I just know, or I can feel it. Or, you know, it all circles back to the idea that I feel this and that makes it true. So that's a big red flag. Do you feel like you can trust this person? Are they constantly telling you something didn't happen, or that something did happen, you don't remember it, like gaslighting, this kind of thing? Because by that time, 6 months to a year should be a little more obvious. Not that there was a narcissist, you wouldn't know that if you didn't run into it. But I mean, the problems in the relationship will probably be more obvious.
Now, you just mentioned gaslighting. That's a term that's came up a few times. That term I've heard a few times over the last couple weeks here. Can you explain specifically what that is and how narcissists use that when dealing with their victims?
Well, gaslighting is when someone is trying to reframe or control another person's reality, their perception of reality. So let's say that you took something from, or excuse me, the narcissist took something from you without asking, and then you are angry at them and you say, hey, you know, why'd you take that when you didn't even ask me? Then they say, oh, no, you said I could do it. Didn't you remember that? That's gaslighting, you know? And most sources will label gaslighting as intentional, as in, you know, that it's a lie, right? Because that's, I consider intentional gaslighting lying. I mean, that's what it is. But there's also, with some narcissistic people, unintentional gaslighting, which is because they remember the situation very differently than you do. I mean, their perception is really, really affected by their emotions and by a lot of other things. And so it may be that they really remember it like that. But, and I tell people this all the time, it doesn't matter if it's intentional or not, because whether they're doing it on purpose or whether they are not doing it on purpose, the effect that it has on you is the same. So does that make sense? Like, it doesn't matter if someone's intentionally lying to you or if they really are remembering it differently, because for you, it's still someone that's trying to assert a reality that does not match your actuality. This is not what happened.
The outcome is the same regardless if it's intentional or non-intentional.
That's exactly right. And that's one of the things that I think is really important to say, because a lot of people, when they hear about gaslighting or they hear about abusive situations and unhealthy situations, it is sort of hammered home that this is all intentional behavior, and it's, you know, they're like these masterminds. And look, some of them are. I mean, you know, the movie that word came from, gaslighting, is, the movie was called Gaslight. And it's an old movie with, I think, Charles Boyer and Ingrid Bergman. And he's essentially gaslighting her because she received an inheritance and he wants that. He wants the money. It's a long story, but he wants the money, the jewelry and all these things. And so he's trying to make her seem like she's unstable. And so he can have her get power of attorney over her and take her stuff. You see what I'm saying? And so most, situations with gaslighting are not that sophisticated, really. I mean, they definitely exist. Excuse me, but most of them are not that sophisticated. But that's one of the things that's really important, is for people to understand that it doesn't matter whether it's intentional or not, because whenever people hear, they really hammer it home, you know, like I said, that it's all this really sophisticated malevolent behavior. If someone is not seeing evidence of that, then they'll think that that's not the problem. And it very well may be the problem.
So complex. Oh, man.
Yeah. It's so true. But, and that's, I think that's really important, though,
for people to understand that it doesn't matter if someone is confusing you on purpose or on accident. This is still, or you know, not on accident, but unintentionally, as in that that's not their motive. It doesn't matter. It's still really, really damaging to be in that situation.
That's when you come in.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah, that's when you come in to help them out. And you also mentioned that a few of your clients have actually been narcissists. Now, mm-hmm. were these people that came to you because they want help, or did they come with their significant other as like a couple's counseling session? I can't imagine.
I'm sorry?
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say I don't do couples counseling, and that's the reason why. No.
Okay.
No, because you know why? It's really too hard. And it's a shame. You know, I meet so many wonderful people. And as like I said, like, unfortunately, that's when I come in. I always tell people, I wish we could have met under different circumstances, you know. But one of the reasons that I don't do couples counseling is because in this kind of situation, I'm not there. I have no idea which one of them is actually the narcissist and which one is not. I mean, over time it would reveal itself because it always does, but that is, couples counseling with a narcissist is a bad idea. It's a bad idea because, you know, counseling requires a dedication and a commitment to resolving the problem. And unfortunately, the majority of narcissistic people are just trying to win. That's all they're trying to do. In order for them to lose, you know, it's a zero-sum game. And in order for them to win, you have to lose. Somebody has to lose. And it's probably going to be you.
Right. Goodness. Now, what about two narcissists? Do you find that people tell you they're married? Like, say you're talking to a narcissist. Are they married to a narcissist or dating a narcissist? What is that relationship like?
Well, it can happen because narcissists are no better at avoiding other narcissists than anybody else is, right? And wounds are attracted to wounds. And so victims have some similar wounds. Narcissists have similar wounds. Other narcissists have, you know, it's very common. And a lot of times we find it also in friendships where there will be sort of like a dominant narcissist, and then sort of the ones that are around are maybe less dominant, or maybe they have more of a codependent type of personality. Not the codependent people are narcissists, but that type of sort of dynamic. And what happens usually is there will be a dominant personality and a sort of a less dominant personality. And also what can happen is that if you're around, let's say you're in a relationship with a narcissistic person for 30 years and you never were able to have access to any information, or you were never able to get educated about what was going on. And so you've kind of been existing in this situation just in survival mode. Because of the way that the ego works and the brain works, it works pretty much the same in everybody. Then what happens a lot of times is the victim starts developing some of the behaviors and mindsets that narcissists have. So sometimes if you see two people that seem narcissistic in a relationship together, it's hard to know if were they both narcissists at the beginning, or this person has been sort of treated so terribly that they have also become like that too. It's hard to say. And also just in general, and you probably know this, the people that we're around, we become like them. I mean, it's really true. Yeah. So if you're around somebody who is, like, let's say you have a preacher with an unimpeachable character, and he hangs around the gang of murderers for 10 years, then what do you think is going to happen? Do you think that he's going to become a little bit less of a holy guy, or do you think they're going to get some preachers?
Yeah, I'd say he'd become less of a holy guy.
Exactly. And so, you know, because that's how it is. When stuff is normalized, so then it's normalized, right? It becomes how it is.
Well, so you mentioned survival mode. So the victims, they enter this survival mode, and they can take on a lot of those, or some of those traits or characteristics of their spouse, their significant other. So I would imagine that would cancel out their, maybe their empathy or any other traits that they have towards other people, right?
It can cancel. It definitely often cancels them out toward the narcissist, for sure. Because, you know, and nobody's proud of that. And there is something we call reactive abuse, which is
sort of along the lines of what we're talking about, where what happens is someone is so defensive all the time, they're in such pain all the time, essentially being in these relationships is literal torture. I mean, it is. And psychological torture, truly, and emotional torture, and sometimes physical torture too. And so, you know, when you're around that situation all the time, then you get into this survival mode, which in some ways is in the same, it's the same that narcissists are in, because narcissists inflict the same type of, or they try to inflict the same type of ego damage on their victims as whatever happened to them, to make them the way that they are, the same kind of wounds that they're carrying around. And so, for example, if a narcissistic person was raised by a narcissistic mother, right? And the mother blamed everything on this kid. And the kid grew up to be a narcissist, and they're used to having everything blamed on them. Well, they're going to be so defensive that they're going to accuse you continuously of blaming them, and they're going to blame you for everything. So if you're in a relationship with them for 5 years and you've been getting blamed for every single thing, you're going to start reacting the same way they do, which is every time someone says something, you're like, well, it wasn't me. And I, you know, it wasn't my fault. I didn't do anything. Or you'll start apologizing, or whatever is the way that you would cope with that. And it just becomes this like knee jerk reaction, because that's what you're expecting all the time. So your ego, narcissism, pathological narcissism really is, you know, I always joke around sometimes and say like it's contagious, right? Because narcissists really do go around and make more people like them. The difference is that they are pathological and people who have been in relationships with them are not. Because you're having a reaction to being abused. This is not your personality. It's not how your mind works. Does that make sense?
So I would imagine that those people are easier to work with or to help, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, because they can look at their behavior and say, I shouldn't have done that, or this is not who I am. And you know what? That's actually the number one reason that I hear from people, that the reason why they ended the relationship. It's usually not, I was afraid. I do hear that, you know, I was afraid of him, or I was afraid of her, or I really just can't take this anymore. I'm tired, I'm exhausted. I hear those things, but probably the number one thing I hear is, I had to get out of this relationship because I was turning into somebody that I didn't like.
Wow. That's interesting, because I was going to ask you, in regards to the people you've helped, and obviously you have helped thousands over the years, once you help someone break through where they come to an understanding that, hey, I need to break free from this person, and they're able to do that, like, what are the chances that their next relationship, it will be with a narcissist, or have most learned their lesson and know what to look out for? Or is that common? Does that happen?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does. And that's the unfortunate part about this whole thing. Because victims have been so attacked, because their egos have been so wounded. And by ego, we're not talking about, you know, like arrogance. We're talking about ego as in the part of you that says I. The deepest part of who you believe yourself to be, that is what is attacked by narcissistic people. And so when we're saying ego, when we're talking about ego work, we're not talking about needing to get over your ego because you think you're all that. You see what I'm saying? We're talking about like who you are as a person and who you believe yourself to be. That is who they attack. So unfortunately, that is what they attack and who they attack. You yourself, the deepest part of you, who you think you are. So for example, if you define yourself as a generous person and someone is going around for 5 years or 3 years saying all you are is selfish and you don't care about anybody, that's a direct attack on who you think you are. You see what I'm saying? And so what happens is, because this has happened to the victim and because they've been so sensitized to these ego attacks, unfortunately, when you try to sort of say to people, you know, you got to look at yourself, they take that as that they're being blamed somehow. It feels like blame because they're just not ready to do that yet. The majority of the people who call me are ready to do it, but it's a process. It takes time. Look, when I was in the relationship with my ex, you know, years ago. If someone would have told me that, I would have been like, what do you mean I need to take responsibility? I'm not the abuser. You see what I'm saying? Because accountability can only be taken. It cannot be given. If you try to give accountability to somebody, it feels like you're blaming them. And that is how everybody feels. And so, but the majority of people that call me are, have gotten to the point where they are ready to do it. And when someone is ready to do that, when they're willing to look at their own wounds and sort of addressing their own vulnerability to these kind of relationships and where did it come from, you know, what's this all really about? And when they can understand it's not about blame, it's actually about empowerment, then when they can do those things, their chances of not ending up with another narcissist are very good.
Shaman, this has been great. I did want to ask you, I saw on your website that you're going to be opening up a center pretty soon. Is that right?
Well, I'm working towards it. We are working towards it. I've been working towards it for a couple of years now. It's a logistics thing, and especially with this COVID thing is really just,
I bet.
It's making it really hard because there are so many things you can't do. Everything is in a stasis of time. I've been talking to people that they've had court dates with divorces or evictions or restraining orders and stuff. They've been pushed back for months, which is really terrible. And so, you know, it's just really a long process. But I do hope to do that. I hope to create a healing center that people can go on retreats that I would either hold or direct in some way, depending on where it is, depending on a lot of things, if I have a team, blah, 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 you know, that kind of thing. Yes, I am hoping to do that. I would love to, there's a lot of things I would love to do because there's so much needed here. I mean, that's like you were saying at the very beginning that I run, I do a, it's virtual, you know, right now because of there's so many things, but you know, I do a rehab for toxic relationships. This really is something you need to be rehabilitated from physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, you know, not just because it's so damaging and horrible, but because there is such an addiction element here, which is something that does not get talked about enough.
And I assume that addiction is no different than any other addiction, maybe even worse in some ways.
Yeah. And one of the things I always tell people is, you know, it's worse because let's say you're trying to kick heroin or let's say you're trying to kick cigarettes. The cigarettes don't come knocking on your door at 3 o'clock in the morning begging you to forgive them and let them in. That makes it a lot harder, right?
So where can people find you? How can they get in contact with you?
Well, they can go to littleshaman.org. That's my website. If they want to send me an email, book an appointment with me, all the information about the workshops, the clinics, the seminars, all the stuff that I do throughout the year is there. Excuse me. You can find my podcast on YouTube. It's also on, you know, Spotify, iTunes, all the big podcast outlets. And so that's really where the majority of this, if you want to hear all my podcasts, they're all on YouTube. They're not all on Spotify and iTunes and stuff like that, but they are all on YouTube. There's probably about 400 of them.
It's a lot. I listened to several. And to people listening to this podcast, if you want to learn more, check her podcast out on YouTube. Very informative, covers just about almost any and every subject in regards to narcissistic abuse that you can imagine. Very helpful. Very helpful. That's an awesome thing you're doing for sure.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I really respect what you're doing too. If there's one thing we need, it's more voices, right? It's more voices saying, because look, you have, and I don't want to proselytize here and get up on a soapbox, but you know, there are people on social media that have followers and all they post is silly memes and they have like millions of people. You know what I mean? We need more voices saying the type of things that you are saying. So I want to tell you, I really respect that.
Thank you so much. And, you know, like I told you before, I respect what you're doing. You have, you know, we're doing something great. We're serving people. So many hurt people out here, right? The help is needed. So we're just out here trying to help people, trying to serve people, trying to love more people. And a lot of those people that you mentioned that are
showing all those pictures and memes and all that, those are probably some of the most hurt people, you know. But it's their mask, if you will, you know. And we're just in this thing trying to do the Father's work, that's for sure.
Yes, and that's exactly how I look at it. And I want to thank you for having me here to talk, because I think it's really important that if there's a blessing, because we're called to look for the blessing, right? So if there's a blessing in these relationships, you know, all the terrible stuff you have to go through, and, you know, to be perfectly frank, it was terrible. He was very physically abusive for years and years and years. So, but if there's a blessing, it's that when you go through these relationships, whether it's your mom, whether it's your sister, whether it's your husband, whether it's a brother, whoever it is, you now have information that a lot of people need. And I think it's really important for us to pay that forward, right?
Absolutely. That's the key. That's the key. And, you know, we touched on that a bit before we started the podcast. You know, the Most High God, the Father, whatever we want to call it, works in mysterious ways. And he allows us to go through certain things so we can then turn around and be a servant to others. Because how could we talk about the things we talk about without having that experience ourselves? So we may be one person going through what we go through, but we turn around and help thousands and hopefully millions, if not billions, one day. So that's beautiful. That's beautiful. So
I love it. And I'm speaking with you. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask you one last thing. If you could please share something with the Hidden Gateway audience that they can take with them, you know, just something, or maybe 20, 30 seconds, something that you want them to know that they can take to heart and move forward with, what would it be?
The most important thing, the key to beating all of this, is love yourself. That's it.
Love yourself. There it is. Like you said, that's it. Once we learn how to love ourselves, that opens up a whole new world for us.
It does, because, in the Bible, it says, love your neighbor as you love yourself. And in some ways, some people might take that to mean your neighbor's supposed to come first. No, that's not true.
Right.
But God wants you to love yourself like he loves you. And then you can love your neighbor the same way.
Yes, that is so true. And that's something I've learned over the last year or so, you know, because I was always the type of person to put others before me, which is okay in some situations, but you know, I had to learn how to love myself first before I could love others. And, you know, that has definitely been life changing for me. It's given me more confidence, more strength, more freedom. It's been able to help me step into my greatness, to step into doing the Father's work. So that's beautiful. Love yourself first. There you go, people. Love yourself first. Well, once again, a little shaman, I want to thank you so much for being on the Hidden Gateway podcast. This has been a wonderful conversation. I want to wish you nothing but blessings and positive energy. I know you'll continue to do your good works for the world. People, you know where to find her. She provided her YouTube channel and her website. Check her out. Hit her up if you need help. She's out here doing the Father's work, helping people. And with that said, I want everyone to move forward with love, freedom, and light. The Hidden Gateway, out.